Good morning. This is Talking Animals. My guests today will be James Levesque and Jenny Stein, founders of Tribe of Heart, responsible for making such notable documentaries as Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home, and The Witness. We'll speak with them in a few moments. Later in the program, we'll also talk with the organizer of the Acoustic Animal Jam, taking place this weekend in Dover. And we'll give away tickets to see Modest Yahoo, who's playing the Tampa Theater February 23rd. First, though, we'll kick off the show with a brand new animal tune of sorts from Johnny Cakes and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypso, who were so fantastic at the Talking Animals Music Night last March, where they played this song. This is indeed Johnny Cakes and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypso with B-Truck here on Talking Animals.
When all of a sudden, right next to me, come this great big truck. It was full of bees. Hey man, didn't you know the bee truck's coming to your town? Hey man, didn't you know you better watch out when the bee truck is around? Cycle man without his helmet. He should have gone, hit the gas and raced, but instead he stuck around and got stung in the face. Oh no! Hey man, didn't you know the bee truck's coming to your town? Hey man, didn't you know you better watch out when the bee truck is around?
That was Johnny Cakes and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypso with B-Truck from their brand new album, Curse of the Unsinkable Ship. They're holding a CD release party this Friday, January 18th at the Crowbar. Great new CD from a great band and great friends of Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Suss. This is Talking Animals, and my guests today are James Levesque and Jenny Stein, founders of Tribe of Heart, a multifaceted nonprofit charitable organization best known for making award-winning documentary films, Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home, and The Witness. With a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome James Levesque and Jenny Stein, to Talking Animals. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Duncan, how are you doing?
Great. Thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Well, we're really glad to be here.
Well, I feel like there's much to discuss here. Of course, I want to delve into the films and explore with you both the notion of filmmaking as activism, as a catalyst for change. But first, let's see if we can't develop some context for those topics by learning a bit about Tribe of Heart and about each of you. Maybe, Jenny, you could describe how you and James met, what you each were doing then, and then how the relationship evolved.
Right. Well, I was in film school at UCLA, getting a master's degree, and James was writing novels, and we met through a creative project that we were working on together that was adapting one of his novels into a screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
And our work went through many different incarnations after that point, but probably about 7 years later, we founded Tribe of Heart because we had taken a detour to pay off our student loans into an area that wasn't feeding our souls. And after doing that for a while, you know, it really became clear to us that we needed to get our work focused on what we cared about most. And that's where Tribe of Heart came from, is kind of a year of soul searching,
and
where we felt we were sort of standing on the sidelines of what we cared about, and we wanted to be right at the center.
Okay, so that was part of, among other things that was happening over those 7 years, is, hey, we don't want to just be spectators in this one. We want to jump right in and get directly involved.
Yeah, you know, many times over the years, we've had a chance to talk to people, and there seem to be so many people who feel this way, you know, that we see things on the news that are disturbing and that upset us about what's happening in our world and our communities. And, you know, we have a lot of feelings and a lot of opinions about what is happening, and we care. But then, you know, what a lot of us are doing for our living doesn't directly apply to the things we care about most. And that can be a very uncomfortable and disturbing situation. And we always encourage people to try to bridge that gap and to work in the direction of making, you know, the work that provides the support for our livelihood to be about the things that we care about and to contribute to making things better.
Yeah, get those things more in sync if they're not.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem in our society because the needs out there are just so great, and there's just not enough of us working on these pressing problems.
For sure. And how did you arrive at the name Tribe of Heart, by the way?
Well, it's a really interesting story. When we had taken a hiatus from, you know, our workaday jobs in order to really find ourselves and get our lives aligned with our values, one of the things that we did is we made a list of experiences that we'd had that had been really discouraging and didn't feel like a good use of our time, and experiences that felt like they were really important, good things came out of them, and we learned a lot. And the experiences that were positive were all over the place. They were in all different kinds of contexts, and, you know, sometimes they were personal, sometimes they were professional, and we kept looking at that list and trying to understand what ties all these things together that felt like they were the right direction. And we started to realize that what it had to do with was who we were working with. And we realized that whatever the context, whether it was commercial or personal or, you know, creative, if we are working with people that were heart-centered, who had this sense of empathy for others and you know, value for compassion, no matter what we were doing, we felt it was worthwhile. And so we realized that what we needed to do was take this thing that was sort of happening randomly, you know, sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't, and more or less put it on the sign over over the building and that it would draw in people that had that same value that we did. And it was actually Jenny who came up with this idea. She said, well, you know, there's a tribe of people out there. And they're the heart people. They're the people who are connected and wanting to be empathetic and care and express their caring. And then, you know, that very quickly, you know, turned into Tribe of Heart.
Wow, cool.
And it's what's really interesting about it is that it did have an amazing effect that naming our organization that we were forming, you know, that way did tend to draw to us people that we really identified with and who understood our values. And it completely changed our lives to have that kind of connection with most of the people who contacted us.
Wow. So it was more than just kind of a cool name or label. It was sort of a charismatic device, you know, that really spoke to others in that same way.
Yeah, I think it's embodying a principle of trying to align one's life with one's values and then to also live transparently. So, in other words, the closer you can name and describe what you're doing to what it really is, the more likely it is that you're going to be connecting with people that resonate with those same values, those same goals.
Yeah, yeah. So you have this great name, and it's you know, seems to have that kind of effect from the get-go. How did you settle on the first Tribe of Heart project? How did you find it, or how did it find you?
Well, that's also a story that has to do with Jenny, actually. we had been, you know, through this process, and we decided that we're going to do, for the rest of our lives, we're going to do work that we believed in 100%. And along the way, in coming to that, We had also seen a film called Man vs. Animal, To Love or Kill on HBO that was very powerful, having to do with, you know, the contradictions of the human-animal relationship. And we saw this film completely randomly, just turned on the TV, there it was, and it really struck us. Something just happened between the two of us at the same time, and we had this feeling, this is something for us. You know, this is, there's many problems in the world, but somehow this situation, the relationship between humans and animals, is a situation that is crying out for more understanding and for change. And so we knew that that was coming, and we started, you know, reading books and studying the issue, and then, you know, we learned about this conference that was happening, and I really didn't want to go. I kept saying to Jenny, we're not ready, we don't know enough, and she was like, we have to go to that conference.
And what was the conference?
It was an animal rights conference in 1997.
Okay.
And, you know, so basically she was so insistent on going, and I was so resistant on going. Finally she said, well, if you don't go, I'm going to go with my mom. And
wow.
I said, all right, I'll go.
Okay. Pulled out the right card, I guess, yeah.
That's right. She pulled out the mom card, and
yeah,
that was heavy duty. And,
yeah.
So then we went to this conference, and then, you know, maybe Jenny can say a little bit about what happened at the conference.
Yeah, well, at that point, I think that because we were... We were vegetarians at the time and kind of hadn't really made the full understanding of what it meant to be vegan. And so we were getting a lot of eye-opening experiences at this conference. I mean, you know, we were like empty cups filling up with all this knowledge and information. And we were just so fascinated with what brought people to that point where they had the aha moment. You know, for some people it's gradual. Some people have a light bulb go off, you know, from one experience. And that moment or that process and series of moments was so fascinating to us because we felt that it held the key of, you know, how to make positive change happen. And so I was going around and asking people about their stories, and really every story was amazing. I don't think there was a boring story I heard during the course of that event. And so at one point there was like a mixer, and I wanted to go to that, and Jim didn't want to go. He was tired and wanted to stay in the hotel room. And I just once again insisted that we go. I had this, you know.
I'll get mom on the phone if I have to. Right,
right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You don't want to deal with mom.
Right.
No, she's actually a very sweet person.
Yeah.
But you know, he I dragged him kicking and screaming to this mixer, and we, you know, there was somebody there who didn't look like your typical animal rights activist. Not that there is a typical look, but, you know, some people just are so out of the stereotype that you have to wonder, wow, what brought this person here?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy who looked like a truck driver, and in fact, he had been a truck driver. You know, he'd had the tattoos, muscle shirt, and I went up to him, and I wanted to know, well, what brought you here? And he proceeded to tell me this amazing story. You know, I won't go into that story because... But what happened next was you know, I told him, well, that's an amazing story. And he said, oh, if you think my story's amazing, you should meet Eddie. And that was Eddie Lama, who's the subject of The Witness, our first film.
Yeah, he said something really funny. He goes, this person said, yeah, you know, you got to talk to Eddie. He's got this van. and then so he wasn't blowing smoke. You know, we went over and started to talk to Eddie Lama, and we just made an immediate connection. It was just one of those amazing moments in life where you connect with somebody and you just have a feeling that, you know, your lives are going somewhere in the same direction, even though, you know, he was from New York City and you know, had a totally different life history than us.
Mm-hmm.
He was at a similar point in his journey of awakening to the issue. He had just created his FaunaVision van, which was really creating a revolution in street-level activism because he was taking this van out on the streets,
yeah,
actually showing people imagery of what happens to animals right there, you know, on the sidewalks of New York City. And it was having this amazing impact. It was not what anyone expected. Nobody expected that people on the street would be so interested and connect so strongly to the animals. And this was just, you know, his awakening was amazing, and then how he responded to it by creating a whole new form of activism was amazing. And, you know, we realized that, you know, this is a person who's got a story to tell who can change lives.
For sure. So this might be the perfect point that will also help a lot of listeners who may not be familiar with The Witness to sort of get caught up, to maybe just give us the sort of brief overview of The Witness and Eddie, who you allude to so far in the story.
Well, you know, the story of The Witness is the story of a person from a background that people have a lot of preconceived notions about. Eddie grew up in a tough Brooklyn neighborhood. You know, he has that strong New York City, Brooklyn accent. And, you know, he's a very forceful, intense guy. And, you know, upon just, you know, meeting him, the last thing people would say is that he's a person out there rescuing animals and advocating for animals. You know, he just defies every stereotype that people would have. And what the film is about is how such a person, who actually grew up in a home, in a family that had a special, you know, kind of an aversion to animals, so he was even more removed from connecting with the beings that share the world with us. You know, he was just a completely urban, concrete world kind of person. And then what happened was that, you know, at fairly late in his life, he was seeking a date with this beautiful woman, and she said, "Well, you know, will you babysit a kitten for me?" You know, and it's a point in the film that people laugh a lot because, yeah, you know, he was, you know, he indicates that this is, like, offensive and, like, way too much to ask, but he wants the date, so he does it.
Yeah.
And, you know, just him and this little kitten alone in his apartment make this connection, and he has a revelation, and he realizes that animals are individuals, that they have wants and likes, and that they connect, and then everything, he realizes everything he learned about animals was wrong, and this little tiny kitten sends him on a journey that turns his life upside down. And within a very short period of time, Eddie Lama Construction Contractor becomes Eddie Lama Animal Advocate. And it's a story that touches people of all different backgrounds. And, you know, 13 years after it was released, it's still out there. It's still being screened. In fact, it's screening in Warsaw, Poland tomorrow.
Wow. Well, yeah, it's as I think we'll get into and sort of you know, sort of a theme of your work and then therefore probably some of our conversation here. But it's really, you know, clearly a story about transformation. And as you say, I mean, Eddie's background would not have hinted at the work that he ended up doing and sort of the advocate and activist that he ended up becoming. And the film really captures that, and as you say, then the response to your film, The Witness, sort of chronicling all this, you know, was powerful. I mean, lots of film festivals, lots of awards, reviews. I grew up reading, long retired now, but the Pulitzer Prize-winning TV critic at the LA Times, Howard Rosenberg, said, among other things, made the most important and persuasive film about animals ever made. So really, obviously, I mean, between his story and how you guys captured and presented it, it was a powerful, powerful combination.
It really was, and I think one of our insights in our work, one of the core insights is that one person's change of heart can change others. You know, that this phenomenon of awakening is something that we as human beings share between each other, and when we share it, it can have an amazing effect. You know, that it really doesn't necessarily take years and years. It can be something that can happen over a very short period of time, particularly when somebody who's been very deeply affected by a social justice issue shares what they've been through. And then the second insight we had was that, you know, there's really, you know, people who are working for justice often feel a need to, you know, tell the public the hidden truth, you know, the things that go on behind closed doors and the terrible suffering and injustices that go on. And what we understood kind of intuitively was that that is half of the story. And that's, you know, it's a difficult part of the story. It can change your life, but it's hard to get through.
Yeah.
And what we figured out was that the other half of the story is this wonderful change that occurs in a person's life who embraces that challenge and tries to take responsibility for what's happening in society and make a difference. And when that happens, it is so inspiring that it gives all of us the strength to take in the difficult truth of what's going on. And so with our films, we try to present both of those realities in bold relief. You know, the reality of the injustice and the reality of the beauty that comes into our lives when we embrace our human responsibility, our compassion, and our love of justice. Those things are so compelling and inspiring that they give us strength.
Right. Well, that brings me to a handful of other questions. Let me first let folks know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Jenny Stein and James Levesque, founders of Tribe of Heart, a multifaceted organization that's produced the documentary films The Witness, which we're just now talking about, and Peaceful Kingdom, The Journey Home, which we'll talk about shortly, I'm sure. If you'd like to ask Jenny and James a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So in the same way that Eddie has made these kind of discoveries and changes, it sounds like from what you just described a moment ago, James, that through that process, and again, seeing what happened with not only Eddie, but people's response to the film that you made about Eddie, that you guys yourselves had a further kind of awakening, and you were obviously, I'm sure, excited and gratified by the response to the film. And so in the wake of that and sort of this additional awakening you've described, what, you know, when did you start pondering after The Witness and all that great response? When did you start pondering what the next project would be? I mean, documentaries notoriously take a long, long time to produce and just, you know, getting started and pulling the money together, all that stuff. But it seems like there's a pretty sizable gap, as it, you know, at least on paper, between when The Witness came out and when Peaceable Kingdom was released.
Well, when we started out making the first film, The Witness, we actually had conceived of it. You're going to laugh, you know, knowing what you do about the animal issue. That we had this, we studied the issue, and we said, you know what, we're going to deal with this animal issue with one-hour documentary. We're going to do 15 minutes on fur, 15 minutes on farm animal issues, 15 minutes on vivisection, and 15 minutes on the connection between violence to humans and violence to animals. And then we'll have addressed the whole thing.
Wow, that's great. Nice and tidy, yeah.
Yeah, that was our brilliant plan. And what happened is that when we went out to film the first 15-minute segment on the fur issue, which was an issue that Eddie Lama, you know, became very committed to, we realized, wow, you know, we thought we were filming a 15-minute segment, but we've got a whole feature film right here in this segment. So really what happened was that quite naturally, since that's what happened with the first segment, the second segment of this one-hour documentary was to be about farmed animals. And then so we actually, in 1999, very shortly after we had done the filming for The Witness, we began filming, for this this farm animal issue. And it turned out that it was a very long process for us to develop a film that we felt was definitive and really addressed this extremely complex issue of farmed animals. And you know, it was a long, challenging journey with many ups and downs. And, you know, at the core of it, I think that, you know, we were struggling with the fact that this is something that the entire planet is caught up in. It's so interwoven into culture and society. And it took us a long time to understand the issue and how to teach about it as a matter of justice.
And James and Jenny, I mean, you know, it seems like, yeah, like you say, there was a lot of challenges. It seems like there were all kinds of struggles. And, you know, in some of the video features online or that accompany the DVD of Peaceful Kingdom, you sort of intimate that there were struggles that you contended with that were not only sort of, again, the sort of indie documentary filmmaker kind of struggles, but others that sort of slowed you down, sent you off track, and just, you know, beyond that money was tight or resources are limited, but these were beyond that. I mean, I don't know if to what extent you want to talk about some of those things, because, again, it sounds like yet another kind of awakening, just to kind of perpetuate the use of that word, that wasn't always entirely pleasant.
Well, you know, we're happy to talk about it because it's part of the journey of advocacy. And you know, one way of thinking about it is that when you take on an injustice and you want to try to make things better, it draws you closer, you know, as you commit to that work and you delve into it, it draws you closer and closer to the nature of injustice and what allows it to exist in society. And that's actually a really difficult journey. It takes you to places you never expected. It asks you to overcome challenges that you didn't know even existed. And one of those challenges, and this is true, I think, of every justice movement, is that, that as the issue gains public awareness, forces of resistance arise. This happened with the issue of human slavery, for example, and as more and more people began to question this institution of human slavery, forces of resistance began to arise. And, you had people on the one hand who were saying, well, the institution of slavery is, perfectly valid. You just have to do it the right way. And our discussion should be how to do slavery in the right way. And in that era, that meant how do you practice slavery in a Christian manner. Mm-hmm. And then there were other people who said, you know what, this institution is inherently unjust. There's no way to fix it. We have to end the practice of slavery. This can't work. It can't. There's no way to practice this. And
there's no good version of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it's the same with the animal issue, that there is the same kind of divide, there's the same kind of conflict, and that's one aspect of the struggle. And then the other aspect of the struggle is that the problems that, we have in our society of, if we look at, why our government doesn't work as well as we would like, there are all these forces and motivations that people have that aren't necessarily... Are the way that they present themselves, but they have personal ambitions. They have agendas that are not necessarily public, and it causes a lot of effort to try to make things better to be frustrated. And those kinds of people and those kinds of problems exist in the world of advocacy as well.
Yeah.
And every advocate who sticks with a cause with commitment over a period of time, sooner or later, runs into these things. And it takes you on a personal journey where you have to confront your own disillusionment, you have to work through it, and you have to develop a deeper understanding of why you're doing what you're doing and what it takes to actually be effective, and it's not always what you thought when you started.
Yeah. Well, it certainly sounds like, and again, I don't want to spend too much time on this just because I don't want to run out of time, I know we have at least some callers that want to get in on the conversation as well, but again, and somewhere in there, that it's really clear that more specifically kind of the struggle you're talking about is that people that seemed prominent, influential in the philanthropic nonprofit advocacy realm and might have been considered role models then, and some of your experiences along that path turned out to be not quite that. The emperor wasn't always wearing at least as many clothes as they seemed to be, and that there was some fairly awful or exploitative or even, I think the one word you guys use is predatory things that happened that sort of, I think, really caught you off guard and really sort of deterred you from the path of other work and making the next film, for example.
Yeah, well, I think that's just a reality, and I think that the other thing that is really important to put out there at the same time, that's a reality, but what kept us going was contact with people doing work for animals and work for justice in their communities, and contact with those activists whose work is largely unsung, and also people working a lot of times at smaller organizations. The people out there are so well motivated, they're so hardworking. They have such a spirit of community and altruism that, we could never give up, because those people, in a sense, are who we work for, making, outreach and communications tools and films for transformation for these people who just want to make things better and who care with such passion about this cause, always brought us back to our center, no matter how difficult other experiences were that we have.
Yeah.
So we really put our faith in that, and we have... a more skeptical view of, large organizations and charismatic leaders. And, kind of our society has somewhat of a cult of personality that goes on these days. And, I just have found that advocates out there in the community understand the issue as well as anybody. They work as hard as anybody else, and their efforts are just unsung, but they're great efforts, and they're worthy of so much support.
Yeah, and I should mention, by the way, I'm going to see if we can take one of these callers and get them involved as well. But that, you know, as some people knew that I had invited you on the show and were all excited about it, at least one of them said, you know, they do great work. They're probably a bit, you know, under the radar for a lot of people, and their own efforts are probably unsung. But to us, they're rock stars. So just following up on your unsung thing, that's certainly been applied to you just in recent days pertaining to this interview. So, hi, you're on Talking Animals with James and Jenny. Hello?
Yes, sir. I have a comment for Mr. Levesque and Miss Stein.
Okay.
Hello, this is Avalon Tyson from Conserve It Forward, and I wanted to say that I watched Peaceable Kingdom, and I really liked it. I've been a vegetarian for 5 years, and I am on day 12 of being vegan. I said I would try Dirty Days, but seeing a movie like yours inspired me to go longer. Thank you so much, Mr. Stein, Ms. Stein, and Mr. Levesque for making films like this, and it really inspires others to act.
Well, thank you, Avalon. I don't know if you guys want to respond. Let me just quickly say that Avalon is a 12-year-old sort of award-winning conservationist and frog expert, has a website, and has been on Talking Animals both when I've been hosting and over the holidays when a friend of mine, Bev, filled in. So she's already well on her way, and that sounds like high praise for you guys.
Wow, well, thank you. That's really exciting to hear, and it's wonderful to hear from someone who at pretty early in life is focused on some of the most important issues that are going on. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize the importance of amphibians and our ecosystem and how, you know, what happens to them is telling us what is going to be happening to so many species over time. And I think someone who's putting that larger picture together, who starts to think about what kind of a diet is going to be good for our planet, good for people, good for the animals, good for our ecosystem, and, you know, if a person with that kind of a background starts to eat a vegan diet, I think that they're really putting the picture together.
Yeah.
It's really exciting.
It really is.
I think when you're that young and you have a passion like this, it's really special, and you need to pursue it and be supported in it. And, you know, I can speak for myself that I spontaneously wanted to be a vegetarian when I was 7, and nobody around me, I didn't even know what a vegetarian was until, as soon as I knew, I said that's what I want to be. And so there were no outside influences, but it was such a strong thing for me. And I loved animals, but I never really put all the pieces together until I was in my 30s. And so I think that it's really important to pay attention when you're that young and you have such a strong ambition to help and you care so deeply to nurture that in yourself and to have the people around you nurture that. So I just wanted to share that because the 7-year-old in me who became a vegetarian is connecting with this 12-year-old in you. So.
Oh, cool. Well, that's really awesome. Well, again, Avalon, thank you for calling in and joining us again on Talking Animals. And so, James and Jenny, gosh, you know, we're somehow hurtling towards the end of our time. So let me just at least ask you to talk maybe a little bit more directly. We've kind of circled around this in a sense, but about what filmmakers and other artists as activists, what that means for you guys and how that, propels your work.
Well, I think that we're, following a tradition that has existed for a long time of social justice artistry, you know, and making works of art that pertain to social justice issues. And, you know, the connection, I think, for documentary filmmaking and these issues is that, you know, it's like with Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home, we're telling the story of 7 people who grew up in multi-generational farm families who go through a complete revolutionary change in their relationship to animals, and they go from, you know, at least 5 of the subjects of the film go from using and killing animals as their living to actually eventually becoming animal advocates. And in doing that, you know, we're telling the story of those individual people, but our ultimate goal is really to tell the story of an entire issue, to tell the story of a time in our society's evolution when, you know, large numbers of people are beginning to question what has gone unquestioned for hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of years. And the arts play a role in transformation because it is a form of human activity that brings the heart and the mind together. And both the heart and the mind have to be in sync for deep transformation to occur. So film and documentary is actually one of the few methods and mediums of communication now where a whole group of people will come together, focus on an issue intensively for an hour or 2 hours, and then be able to have a dialogue about it. That kind of experience is now pretty uncommon in our society and in any other context. So we find that film is a way to really get a whole group of people have the common experience of viewing the film, and then there's something to talk about that brings people together. Everybody has gone through this experience, and the film, really challenges everyone to think about, well, who are these animals? There's an injustice going on, but who is it happening to? And that social justice artists are almost, that is always a big part of their work. On the one hand, revealing the hidden injustice, and on the other hand, getting everyone to think a little more deeply about, well, who is this injustice happening to, and how are the preconceived notions and prejudices that we have causing us to go along with this injustice? Why do we think this is okay? Well, partly because we have these ideas about these others that are being exploited that are just not true.
Yeah.
And once we begin to realize that they're not true, then the door opens to taking greater responsibility and starting to change things.
Right. I should say, too, that sort of part of the Tribal Heart efforts to sort of influence and sort of seek to galvanize, raised awareness and transformation and sort of now fostering a ripple effect, sort of globally is that, you're been making some international inroads. The witness that we talked about earlier is online and available, I think, in five or six languages: English, obviously Spanish, Russian, Polish, Slovenian, and others are coming. And Peaceful Kingdom, I think there's translated versions of the movie itself or DVDs, screenings, making their rounds internationally as well. So again, it's that, like you say, it's that experience of if you're sitting in a theater, you're having that shared experience. But even if you're just watching it online and you haven't otherwise been exposed to it or watching it at home on DVD or otherwise, you're still kind of getting that effect, even if you're not exactly in the group setting you initially described, James.
Right. Well, it's a little bit, it's a modified version of that experience because people are watching things online and talking to each other and chatting and going on Facebook and other social networking media.
Sure.
And so there's a sense of, currency, immediacy, that we're all kind of thinking about this at the same time, and that has now gone to a global level. And there are really exciting developments happening globally with young activists who are, coming to a new understanding of how to make change happen, and they want to do things for themselves. They aren't really interested in forming large organizations or just becoming members of large organizations. They're much more independent, and they're much more collaborative on a global level. And it's very exciting for us to have a chance to work with some of these young activists, for example, in translating our films and showing them in other countries. And it's just a wonderful privilege to work with people that are onto this issue. They're some of the pioneers of it in their culture. And they're such intelligent, hardworking, and clear-thinking people, and they teach us a lot. And that's what the hope is. And it's something that when we started out, we didn't really know. We wondered, hey, will people in other cultures relate to this? Will they grasp what we're trying to say here? And one thing that I always like to say is that the response to our films across cultures is amazingly consistent, that this compassion and this love of justice is something that is a human capacity, and people in every culture have it, and we in every culture it's something that we can teach each other. There's a huge commonality.
Yeah, it spans cultures, languages, etc. Let me, we are now so far over time, but one of these callers has been holding such a long time. Let me see if maybe we can just sort of conclude with getting them. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with James and Jenny. We have just probably a minute or less, I'm afraid, at this point.
Yeah, not a problem, Doc. And nice to hear some enlightenment coming over the airwaves. This is Peter. And yeah, 23 years as a vegetarian. Day before yesterday, I had a birthday, decided time to step it up and take it to the vegan level. So my friend bought me like six jars. I got six jars of different types of sprouts in there, sprouting as we speak. But anyone, as we all know, who's ever had a pet, at some point recognizes that there's a special spirit within and there's a special connection there. When you make that connection with your pet, that gets translated to cows, to horses, to birds, every other animal on the planet. We're all animated by the same life force, I personally believe. To the young lady, God, how admirable is her decision-making. And, you know, everybody believes so strongly about stuff, they really want to be outspoken advocates, but as the artists are saying, sometimes it's easier to reach people through art than preaching. And Ralph Nader kind of discovered that with his book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, his first fictional work. So, you know, to the young lady, don't be preachy. You'll sway people just by living by example and speaking words of loving kindness. And thanks a lot for the show, and keep up the good work. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for your call, and that's sort of the perfect note on which to end our time today. But James and Jenny, thanks so much for joining me on Talking Animals. We've been speaking with James Levesque and Jenny Stein from Tribe of Heart. Their website is tribeofheart.org. You can find out more about the films that we touched on and some of the other campaigns and efforts they're involved with internationally. And so thank you so much. We didn't get to some of the things I was hoping to, but we got on some very interesting things, got input from some other folks, so that's a good thing, too.
Well, thank you very much for having us, Duncan, and for all your work for the animals and our planet.
All right, well, right back at you. Thank you very much.
Okay,
take care
now.
Bye-bye. Thanks, bye-bye. All right, in just a few minutes, we'll speak with Sherry Hornsby, chief organizer of the Acoustic Animal Jam, a festival which partly consists of bands with animal names performing this weekend in Dover. Right now, though, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is Nick DiPaolo with a part of a piece called Animal Activists on today's Comedy Corner. I'm talking animals.
I'm sick of activists. Everybody's a goddamn activist in Los Angeles. Everybody's like an animal activist. I love animals too. But you know, if I see one more person walking a dog with a coat on it, I'm gonna stab him. I swear to God. That's the first sign of mental illness. You start dressing up your pets, okay? Take the snorkel jacket off the chihuahua. The dog was born with a coat. He doesn't need another one. It's like giving an alligator false teeth. Leave him alone. Gee, that's on the lawn. He licks his own balls. Let's buy him a tweed jacket. We don't even have kennels now. We have doggy hotels in this country. Did you see this? We got people sleeping on the streets in this country, yet somewhere there's a poodle pissed off because a maid didn't leave a liver snap on his pillow last night. I got a lady that lives next to me that talks to her pets like she thinks they're human. She's yelling at her dog last week. She's going, "Did you hear what I said? Did you hear what I said?" I go, "You know, I think his hearing's perfect. It's the English language that's throwing him off a tad. Maybe he can't hear you because he's wearing earmuffs and a hat."
All right. That was Nick DiPaolo with part of a piece called Animal Activists, taken from his album Born This Way. Okay, to fill us in on this weekend's Acoustic Animal Jam, let's welcome Cherie Hornsby to Talking Animals. Good morning, Cherie.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. Tell us about the Acoustic Animal Jam, how the idea came about, and how it's evolved since then to become this weekend's two-day extravaganza.
Well, we were all sitting around one night really late at night after jamming, and we're talking about all the different bands that had, local bands that had animals in their, the title of their band, and we thought it would be cool to all get together, and hence the Acoustic Animal Jam was born.
Cool. And but it seems like from just something that sort of was kicked around and having fun, it's become a full-fledged event and then some.
Yes, we're pretty. A couple of the members of the bands that I play in are very active with Dalmatian Rescue of Tampa Bay, and we always try to do something that's kind of twofold. And so, Dalmatian Rescue of Tampa Bay will be our featured charity for this event. They're going to be there with some Dalmatians for adoption, and then also going to be doing a 50-50 raffle.
That's so great. So, given the premise of the festival and of course its name, I guess let's hear about at least a few of the bands and with the animal names.
Well, five of the nine performers or bands that are playing have animals in their name. The first band is Psychedelic Possums. Then we have Cotton Eye Does, which is an all-girl band. And then we have Free Range Roosters. And then there's Little Girl and the Dreadful Snakes. And then finally, closing out the night on Saturday night, will be Big Bear Franchise with this kind of like a Southern rock feel to it.
Cool. So let's make sure we're not glossing over the kind of some of the other key elements, Cherie. Tell us exactly where this is happening and beyond this weekend, when, you know, what the hours are and how people can find out more information if they're inclined to sort of jump in and get tickets to this hoot.
Okay. It's going to be in Dover, Florida, just right off of 60 on the north side of 60. If you're on Facebook, you can do www.facebook.com and then type in Acoustic Animal Jam, and it should pull up the festival. Also, they're free to give me a phone call at 863-397-4497 if you'd like to talk about it some more. And there's some very reasonable low-cost, very reasonable and low-cost entertainment for 2 days and nine bands worth of entertainment.
Right, and if I understand it correctly, you can camp, but I suppose you have the option to not camp. And do you similarly have the option, if just your schedule was such that you couldn't go for both days, could you go for one or the other?
Well, it kind of started out just being a one-day festival,
yeah.
And I've pretty much kept the same rate and made it a two-day festival. So whether or not you go on just Friday or just Saturday, it's still just $20.
Wow. So you get a day for free, I think is what you're saying. Yeah.
You get a day for free.
Yeah, no matter how you slice it. Well, this is really cool. This sounds like it's going to be really, really fun. And how would you kind of characterize, I'm sure there's quite an array, but just generally, what kind of music would people expect to hear if they're not familiar with some of these bands just based on their names?
It's going to be kind of Americana, folk, some bluegrass and jamming. Slight jazz to some of the feel to some of the bands, and then just one of the bands is a bluegrass kind of almost not, I won't say punk, but very very fast band.
Cool.
It
heavy.
And then some southern, yeah, kind of heavy, and then like a southern rock feel to the last band, a kind of acoustic. Acoustic rock.
Wow. All right. So it sounds like it covers a lot of ground and sounds like it's going to be really fun.
Yeah.
Well, Cherie, thank you so much for joining us. And again, you can find it just by on Facebook, just by searching for Acoustic Animal Jam and get all the details and stuff there. And sounds like it's going to be a real blast. So thanks again.
All right. And thank you, Duncan.
All right. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
All right. I'm Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will win a pair of tickets to see Modest Yahoo, who's playing the Tampa Theater February 23rd. And just be a few minutes from now on Talking Animals. Right now, though, it's time for animal news and announcements. I want to start off by mentioning that Kelly McRae, who performed at the Talking Animals Festival in 2011, thanks to our good buddy Loris Vidal, who also performed at the festival and was on tour with Kelly and brought her to play, and she was fantastic. So, according to experts more knowledgeable than I am, that was the first and only time that she's played in this area, but that's being further corrected this Friday. She will be on the live music showcase here at WMNF at 2 p.m., and then at Ella's that night with Rebecca Pulley. So catch one or both if you can. You'll be richly rewarded. Also, so I don't run out of time at the end, I want to mention that Scott's got a great jam-packed fun show, including he'll be interviewing Mavis Staples at some point. That's the All Souls edition of It's the Music coming up right after Talking Animals. And speaking of cool things happening on Wednesday music shows, Surface Noise tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. with Lounge Laura Taylor is going to have an even more all vinyl edition. She always plays a lot of cool vinyl, but sort of in tribute to this being WNF's 33rd and a third anniversary, there's more vinyl. Plus, it directly hooks into WNF's record and book sale happening this Saturday, January 19th. So, check it out. Laura and Lazarus Ortega, Surface Noise, tonight. 6 to 8 p.m. on WMNF here. All right, so we don't have a whole lot of time for animal news, but let me just paraphrase at least something that's been in the Tampa Bay Times and now on national television, and that's that Rick Scott made such a big deal about adopting a nice dog, a nice Labrador Retriever, and of course gave it a name, Reagan. And then the dog kind of disappeared as far as anybody could tell, and no one really in his camp or office or whatever wanted to answer what happened. And anyway, it turns out the dog was a bit rambunctious. They gave him back. They got rid of him. So there's some other dog apparently there, but just very Rick Scott-like, no? Also locally here, people and businesses that promote illegal dog and cockfighting in Hillsborough County may soon have to forfeit their assets, maybe the other thing too, if convicted of animal cruelty charges. County commissioners unanimously passed measures recently that would use a state contraband forfeiture law to confiscate assets of businesses that profit from animal cruelty. The ordinance was sponsored by Commission Chair Ken Hagen, who cited several recent instances of large dog and cockfighting operations, as well as an arrest of a man in Citrus Park who was charged with butchering horses for human consumption. And also Florida-related, the Mary Lee, a massive great white shark known for her wanderlust, reached the destination last week. That made observers uneasy, to say the least. The O-Search team that had tagged the 16-foot, 3,500-pound shark in September received a ping signal that Mary Lee was within 200 yards of Florida's Jacksonville Beach. So, keep a lookout for Mary Lee, right? And, all right, well, I think that's probably all the news we really have time for today, but we'll get into more, hopefully, next week. So, I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals. Or the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway. You do not need to be a WMNF member to win. There'll be a prize, a pair of tickets to see Modest Yahoo, who is playing the Tampa Theater February 23rd. And to the first person who calls in the correct title of this animal song, 813-239-9663. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
He wakes up in the morning, does his teeth bite to eat, and he's rolling, never changes.
All right, we'll take them off air, people know, perhaps. But we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, January 23rd, when our guest will be Dr. Temple Grandin, the internationally renowned expert on both animal cognition and autism. Dr. Grandin herself is autistic and was portrayed by Claire Danes in the award-winning HBO film called Temple Grandin. She's been on the show 3 times over the years and returns to us. Join us live next Wednesday. Hope you'll join us as well for that. All right, we've got a full bank of phone lines lit. Let's take them in the order they came. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Ants marching.
That's right. And I assume you're going to know the artist too, then, with your confident answer there.
Dave Matthews Band.
All right, bonus points. Cool. All right, well, you're going to go see Modest Yahoo on February 23rd at the Tampa Theater. What's your first name, sir?
Mike.
Mike? Okay, I'm going to put you on hold, Mike, and I'll come back and get your information, get you all set up for the show. Thanks for listening. Congratulations.
Cool.
All right,
thanks,
folks, we obviously have a winner. Mike was the first to know and correctly guess. So, anyways, I hope you'll visit our website, TalkingAnimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page or Twitter feed and more. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net, where we'll be launching a sleek, modern, new website any day now. I swear! Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby Vassalis. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the wonderful Scott Elliott, The All Souls edition of It's the Music airing next from noon to 3. Packed full of treasures, including, again, the interview with Mavis Staples. Don't forget Surface Noise tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. with the All Vinyl edition hosted by the fabulous Lounge Laura Taser, Laura Taylor. And we're closing out today's show with an animal song from Moby. This is Pale Horses taking us up to the NPR News on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, WikiWatchy, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks. Take care. Have a great week.
Put me on the train. Send me back my home. Couldn't live without you when I tried to roam. Look at all the places where all my family died, where all my family died, where all my family died, where all my family died. Leave me by the churchyard. Take me back to my